Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the March 12th meeting of the Minnesota House Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. We do have a quorum, and before we move the minutes this morning, I do want to point out one correction, and that is when Representative Finke moved the minutes, we have March 6th on the hard copy. It should be March 10th. That is a typo. That is on the minutes, and I will just incorporate that change right now to being March 10th, which was yesterday, which is the minutes for this meeting. And so with that, Representative Finke.
Last time I say that, these minutes look fantastic. You know, that's too many errors.
So are you passing on moving them this morning, or are you going to move the minutes for us this morning?
I move the minutes and hope that they are correct.
There's not much that can be incorrect on here other than the date at this point. All those in favor of the motion to approve the minutes with the incorporation of the correct date, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails, and we are on to our first bill this morning, House File 1865 by one of our members, Representative Allen. You'll go to the testifying table and get ready to present your bill this morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Allen, just give you 1 minute here to make sure that we've got everything squared away. I think you also have an amendment, and I will allow have you move the bill, and we're going to send this one to the General Register this morning. So if you want to go ahead and move the bill, Representative Allen, to get it before the committee.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move HF 1851 before the committee.
And to be re-referred to the General Register. Recommended to be referred to the General Register.
Recommended to be referred to the General Register.
Very good. And Representative Allen, if you want to go ahead and proceed with your bill, and we'll turn the show over to you.
Mr. Chair, I think that the bill that was moved was the wrong bill. Can we just confirm?
Oh, 1865. Thank you.
1865.
Thank you. Her. Soon to be co-chair her as of Tuesday of next week. Let's start that again. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Representative Allen Booz, House File 1865, to be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Now we have a author's amendment. If you want to talk a little bit about the bill, or we can take the author's amendment first, which is your
We can take the author's amendment first,
okay.
If you're okay with that, Mr.
Yep.
Chair.
So go ahead and offer your A1 to the 1865.
Yes, I have a A1 amendment for HF 1865. Essentially, what it is it's a technical. It was a technical correction that was made by Commerce. They just wanted to make sure the bill did exactly what it was intended to be able to do, and that's why it was made.
Very good. All those in favor of the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails. And Representative Allen, the bill is now amended and in the form you'd like. Go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Lead Her, and distinguished committee members. The bill before us, HF 1865, which makes it easier for consumers to access the equity they have built in their homes. As you know, interest rates have risen dramatically since 2020, and more people are choosing to stay in their current homes rather than losing out on the great interest rates they attained on their primary mortgages. This means more people are looking to a secondary lien or home equity loan to expand or renovate their current space in order to meet their family's needs. For example, if a young family got their one-bedroom starter home at a 3% interest rate in 2020 and recently had a baby, so they're in need of a two-bedroom home. Instead of buying a new home today at 7% or 8% interest rates, they might look to taking a secondary lien to build out another bedroom instead. Secondary liens are the most popular product in mortgage companies today and can offer they can offer in the current climate that we're currently sitting in. Yet in Minnesota, many can't currently access those liens because of statutes that haven't been changed since 1976, which was like the year before I was born, just to keep that in perspective. Well, that makes me really old.
Representative Allen, we are going to ask you to keep those kind of comments to yourselves, given the demographic of some of the people on this committee. You're not enduring yourself to yes votes, just so you know when you do that.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. As we make this landscape change, it will allow for consumers to be able to have easier access to their home equity as more companies will be able to service these loans. With me today to explain further and answer questions is Mike Stedham with Rocket Mortgage.
Thank you, Representative Allen. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you'll state your name and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Michael Stedham. I am the Director of Regulatory Affairs for Rocket Mortgage.
Welcome, and if you'll go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chairman Driscoll and members of the committee. Rocket Mortgage appreciates the opportunity to offer testimony in support of the proposed amendments to the Minnesota Lending Authority Statute, which would expressly exempt loans that meet the federal qualified mortgage standards, the QM standards, from the state's 1% single service charge cap. Under current Minnesota law, there are a few restrictions placed on conventional loans. Conventional loans are defined under Chapter 47 of the Minnesota Banking Law with a different definition than is commonly used. In Minnesota, a conventional loan is a loan under the federal conforming loan limit that is not insured by VA or FHA and is not purchased by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. Lenders originating conventional loans may only charge a single service charge not exceeding 1% of the loan amount. This restriction was implemented prior to the establishment of the federal QM standards with the intent of providing consumer protections on loans that lack protections under VA or FHA requirements or Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac guidelines. The proposed amendments will provide an exception to the restriction for loans that meet federal QM standards, ensuring consumer protections are maintained by imposing a widely relied upon standard that lenders can apply regardless of the investor or insurer of the loan. This proposal will align Minnesota with over 40 states that do not have fee restrictions in excess of the federal QM standards. It will also ensure Minnesota consumers have access to subordinate lien loan products with lower balances, which are currently difficult to originate with the 1% cap due to lenders' fixed costs of originating loans. These challenges impact Minnesota consumers who may be turned away from subordinate lien financing and forced to alternative loan products such as personal loans or credit cards, which traditionally have much higher interest rates. These benefits have led to support for the amendment from the Minnesota Mortgage Association. So in sum, we appreciate the committee's leadership on this matter. Modernizing Minnesota law to align with federal QM standards will ensure consumers are protected and have access to affordable low balance subordinate lien financing. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone from the public who'd like to testify on the matter before the committee? House File 1865. Anyone wishing to testify in 1865, the matter before the committee? Seeing none and hearing none, members, questions for the bill author or the testifier? Remember, he did bring age into this earlier, if I need to remind you.
But, Mr. Chair, in my defense, I did bring bagels. So if anybody needs refreshments. So.
Very good. Very good. Seeing no member questions, Representative Allen will give you the final word on the bill.
Great. I appreciate your support on the bill. Commerce has been extremely helpful. The Department of Commerce has been extremely helpful in terms of crafting it, making sure it does exactly what it's intended to do. And was touched on before, this gives consumers out there in the market just a few more options as we are going forward to be able to do those necessary improvements in homes or whatever they may need for financing. So I would appreciate your support. Thank you.
And with that, Representative Allen renews his motion that House File 1865, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Allen, you are on your way with the House File 1865. Our next bill is House File 2014. Representative Dotsoff. Good morning, Representative Dotsoff. If you would like to move your bill before the committee, it's going to be re-referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move my bill to the 2014 to be moved to the General Registry.
All right. There are no amendments to the bill, so I'm assuming it's in the order and the fashion you'd like it. So why don't you go ahead and tell us what you've got in House File 2014.
Well, first of all, good morning, everyone. This is the bill that you've been waiting for all morning here. So. This bill is just basically a real corrections bill. It's last session, number one, it's a bipartisan bill as well. So it's actually, it's got support from both aisles. Last session, Department of Commerce, Financial Institution, Technical Policy Bill changed the mortgage amount threshold in Minnesota Statute 4720 from $100,000 or less to the FHMA or FHFA threshold to $766,550 or less. This resulted in a large number of real estate loans being pulled into the scope of Minnesota Statute 4720. Department of Commerce staff believed at the time that this change would not impact the loans or originated under the different statute, but that does not appear to be the situation at this point. The change applies to most mortgages of $366,550 or less. Lenders need additional time to amend their mortgages, documents, and reflect the change scope of 4720. This bill extends the compliance date of the last language to give banks more time to comply with Subdivision 8 of Minnesota Statute 4720. The language allows for electronic notice for foreclosure situations if agreed to buy the lenders and borrow in written. If the lenders borrow the money, they can actually do it electronically versus getting served by certified mail. The last two changes reflects the language contained in the Federal National Mortgage Association, FNMA, Standard Mortgage Forum of Minnesota. With me today, I've got Tess Rice, General Counsel for the Minnesota Bankers Association. Tess.
Good morning and welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Tess Rice, General Counsel for Minnesota Bankers Association.
Ms. Rice, we're just going to ask you to pull the mic just a little closer. It's not picking up in this room, we've noticed over the months here. So,
can you hear me now?
We can hear you now.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you to Representative Dotsoff for authoring this bill. So this is a correction we're addressing an issue that came out of Commerce's bill last year. It was inadvertent. 47.20 is not a statute that anyone really paid any attention to because they make loans under other statutes. And that was what Commerce believed, that they were just updating this threshold. But it actually brought in all mortgages under, now it's 806,000 that are made by state chartered banks and by mortgage lenders. It doesn't apply to national banks and it doesn't apply to credit unions. And it meant that we need to get some more language into our in-house mortgages. So bankers, when they keep a mortgage, they make it, they keep it. They need to amend those forms now to comply with the statute. And then that second part of the bill is just so that our state law agrees with the standard Fannie Mae form that is used on almost every mortgage, especially those that are sold on the secondary market. So that's just an update.
Very good. Is there any member of the public here today that would like to testify on the matter before the committee? House File 2014. Anyone wishing to testify on House File 2014 that is before the committee? Seeing none and hearing none, members, questions for Ms. Rice or for Representative Dotsoff? Seeing none and hearing none, Representative Dotsoff, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a good good correction bill, and I appreciate your support.
And with that, Representative Dotsoff renews his motion that House File 2014 be recommended to be referred to the General Register. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you, and you are on your way. Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair O'Driscoll. Chair O'Driscoll, would you like to move your bill to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means?
Thank you. I would move House File 2028 be recommended to be referred from the Commerce Committee to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Chair O'Driscoll, to your bill.
Thank you. There are no amendments, and the state of Minnesota belongs to an organization called NCOIL, and it's the National Council of Insurance Legislators, and many members in the House and the Senate participate in this, and there's an annual and biannual renewal that we have for member participation in this as a state. And what they do is it's a think tank group that takes people from the industry, legislators together, and tries to develop model language. And there's a fee for us to be involved in that here in the state of Minnesota. And so I'd like to make sure that we don't lose track of that in our budgeting process and things. And so I'm bringing this bill before the committee and asking it to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Madam Chair, that is my testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. Is there anyone in the public who would like wishes to testify today? Anyone in the public? Seeing no one in the public, I will go to the members for House File 2028. Any comments from the members? Representative Davids.
Thank you, Chair Perryman. I would strongly support this. I haven't been active in recent years, but in the past, I was very active in this organization, and they do some very, very good things in the insurance area. They work very closely with the NAIC, National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and the dialogue between the two generally really, they really put out some good work, and I think it's very important that Minnesota stay as a member of this group.
Chair O'Driscoll, any comments?
I think you have a question from Representative Katiza-Watoon.
Yes, I do. Representative Katiza-Watoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative O'Driscoll, I support this bill. I've been able to attend a couple of different conferences, and it's a great bipartisan consortium of state legislators, mm-hmm. and really they put together some really informative presentations on a variety of different areas that we cover here in our Commerce Committee. And we get to learn about what Commerce Committee's and insurance-related issues other states kind of discuss that we might not always get to discuss in this committee. So I appreciate you bringing it forward.
We also have a question from Representative Herr.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And, Lead Herr. I correct myself.
That's okay. Chair O'Driscoll, just a quick question because I am new to this committee as well. Can you just tell me a little bit about the history of this particular fee? Like, is this... Do we have to write a bill every biennium in order to appropriate these funds? And I guess if that's the case, why don't we just make legislative changes so that we don't have to do this? Or is there a reason why this particular year there is a bill versus maybe how it's done other years?
Chair O'Driscoll?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Herr, for the question. No better question asked this morning on this topic. And you can see right around the table why, because members are learning exactly what's going on as membership of this commission and this committee changes. It's a good way to be able to inform people about the importance of this organization. And it never hurts to have just a few minutes to talk about this and, again, to ensure that the financing moves to the Ways and Means Committee as they're moving paperwork around to keep that in the Commerce Bill of how important it is as well.
Representative Herr? Lead Herr?
Chair O'Driscoll, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Chair O'Driscoll, then in the past, has it been that we do this every biennium, or does the department absorb this in certain bienniums? Could you just maybe give me a little bit of history on that, just so I know?
Chair O'Driscoll.
Sure. Lead Herr, this is oftentimes built into budgets, and it's done on a biannual basis. We're simply just calling it out this morning for the purpose of what we just talked about. Show folks what the cost is. You've heard members talk about the benefits on it. It's a good investment for us in the state of Minnesota. As a matter of fact, the next topic that we have on our agenda today to talk about homeowners insurance, that is something that NCOIL is taking up because it's not just mutually exclusive to the state of Minnesota for problems. It's nationwide where we have it. So, again, it's an opportunity to be able to feature NCOIL on a day that we're talking about insurance and the important work that they do and that the state of Minnesota be a member of.
Lead Herr, follow-up? Thank you. Any other questions from the members? Seeing no other questions, Chair O'Driscoll, final comments to your bill.
It's a great bill, vote yes.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll, Chair O'Driscoll renews his motion that HF 2028 be referred to the Committee of Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Get this? Although the motion prevails and HF 2028 is referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, and it's on its way. Chair O'Driscoll, you would like to start the next item, which is presentation and discussion on common interest communities and homeowners association?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. It may be a little unorthodox for committees to have the chair or a member of the committee actually testifying and providing feedback on topics that are before the committee, but I do have a lot of professional experience in this area. I think it's important for the committee to get some background, and so I'm going to spend maybe about 8-10 minutes or so just backgrounding with you on what are common interest communities, how are they created, what are some of the challenges that are in there. As we then move to testifiers, we're going to talk about something that we've been grappling with in the legislature with master policies for homeowners associations. And all this will make a little bit more sense when we get into it. And Representative Elkins has been working on some solutions and some different ideas on this. And so we want to address this issue because we know it's a growing need out there. And so with that, Madam Chair, when you think about a common interest community, they can take several different forms. Think of it as a, if you will, as a an apartment building. Instead of having one owner of an apartment building or an entity that owns the apartment building, what you have is individual ownership of units in the building. They, from an insurance perspective, stand and are exposed to the same types of risks: hail, snow weight damage on the roof, and the list goes on and on for those kinds of things. Our focus today is not going to be on multifamily housing or even on cooperatives, which is another form of ownership. But I want to make sure that we understand that not only are common interest community properties, townhomes and condominiums exposed to this, but multifamily, and there's some discussion in the legislature on this, and then cooperatives as well. And a cooperative is simply an entity that's owned by a corporation, and the people who live there are shareholders in the corporation, which entitles them to live in a unit in that cooperative. So if you've driven around the metro area and you've seen it says such and such a cooperative on there, that's what it is. There's a corporation that owns it. Each owner of shares is entitled to a lease that gives them exclusive possession of a unit. With a common interest community, it can be created in two ways. Number one, you can take an existing property and convert that, say, apartment building from individual ownership, the one owner of that, or single ownership of the building, to multiple owners. And what you do is you file what is known as a declaration. You literally change the ownership in the public record in the county in which that property is located, and you move it from one owner to, if the building has 60 units, you basically have 60 owners of these individual units. No other unit owner has any rights to the unit that you purchase. Within the walls of that condo, you have exclusive ownership and possession of that property. It could also take the form of a townhome where you have shared walls with your neighbor, but you own that unit, right? Inside that unit, you own that particular unit and have exclusive possession and use of that property. What the issue that we're looking at today, and we'll hear from the insurance industry, from the Department of Commerce, is when we have weather-related activities or we have other kinds of losses, how do those get paid? Rising cost of insurance is affecting everyone, including the homeowners association. Now, let me step back and talk a little bit about this. If you open up your door and walk outside of your unit, the hallway, the elevator, the roof on the building, all right, the sidewalk, the parking lot, all of those are considered common elements, which means they are owned by everyone who is a unit owner. There's risk liability associated with that, so the association buys a policy or a master contract to protect the owners. How do they pay for that? Each unit owner is assessed a fee on a monthly or annual basis to take care of upkeep, maintenance of the property, snow removal, refuse removal, and the like. included in that would be paying for the annual Homeowners Association master policy. But the master policy does not cover the individual unit owner's risk and liability. So what goes on inside of that unit is the responsibility of that unit owner. So if I were to go and see Chair Perryman at her condo, and she just got done waxing the kitchen floor, and I slipped and fell on that, and I was injured, her insurance would have to take care of that. Versus if I was slipping on the sidewalk, coming to the front door to see her, that's an association liability, because everyone who's a unit owner owns the sidewalk. Okay? So what happens is the policy that I would buy, or excuse me, that Representative Perryman would buy in the industry is called an HO6. I'm not going to get into all the different types of policies, but it's a condo policy. And what it's designed to do is to link up with the master policy to be able to protect the homeowner and the association and to avoid gaps in coverage and uncovered risks for both parties on that. And again, sometimes what happens when you buy an insurance policy, oftentimes the case is you'll have a deductible. So if there is a loss, say for example, there's a hail loss, the roof needs to be replaced on that condominium building and the siding needs to be replaced, the association would be charged a deductible. No different than what you and I would be charged. What happens is, depending upon the size of that deductible, there may not be reserves that have been collected through the monthly association fees by the association to be able to cover the deductible. These HO6 policies also have loss assessment in there. In other words, the homeowner, if they get a letter from the association that says, we don't have enough money in our reserves right now to cover this, we're going to assess each unit owner X many dollars, they may be able to take that claim for their portion of the deductible and go to their individual insurance company that they bought the policy from and receive loss assessment that chip in to pay for that deductible. In addition to those common elements that we were talking about, the hallways, the swimming pool, the fitness area, the sidewalk, we have what are called limited common elements. They are still owned by all unit owners, but not all unit owners get to use those or have access to those. Things like assigned parking in parking garages. You have slot 17. No other unit owner can park there. It's designated for you. If you have a balcony that's off of your unit, outside the unit, not everybody gets to use that balcony, but everybody owns the balcony, your HO6 policy would protect you and your use of that limited common element. And so today what we're going to hear is from the Department of Commerce about how the approval process works. We're also going to hear from others who represent and work with the Homeowners Association and some things from the insurance industry about what the challenges are that we have in being able to secure coverage for these types of properties that I just spoke about. So all of you now are well on your way to getting your Minnesota real estate license, because these are the things that I talk about professionally and have for a number of years in the industry. Madam Chair, if there are questions, I'm happy to take those. We do have a little bit of time. Just again, want to have a nice base for members to be able to do that. And it's also been a long time since I've actually been able to testify in front of the legislature on things other than bills that I've been working on. So Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. I'd buy insurance from you anytime. Are there any members that have comments or questions to Chair O'Driscoll?
Madam Chair, before we do that, I am not allowed to sell you insurance. Our regulators are in the room. I do not have an active license right now, so I would not be allowed to do that.
And I know this is all being recorded, and I confer with you. Representative Dossett, your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. I just want to state that thank you for sharing and being open and actually explaining this information. Even though I'm actually in the real estate industry, every time I sit in front of you, I actually extract and learn new information. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other comments? Seeing none, we do have several presenters, and I guess I will introduce the first one as the Chair O'Driscoll returns to his seat here. We are going to bring up Peter Brickweed. Brickweed. Got it. No. Hard of hearing. Brick Witte, I got it now. So Peter Brick Witte, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Commerce. And Chair O'Driscoll, it's my pleasure to give you your chair back.
Mr. Chair, members, privileged to be back with you.
Mr. Brickley, how long has it been?
Well,
I don't think we've seen you all session.
Mr. Chair, it was 14 years for me at the Commerce Department last Tuesday. But as I think several of you know, I've transitioned into a new role at the agency, so my title is now Senior Director of Insurance Sustainability and Climate. And our focus and my role in that focus has been to try to bring some more resources to bear in our state's home and auto insurance markets. And so my transition into that new role has been part of that, and I've been in that space since October. And you're in very capable hands, as you already know, with Mr. Smith and our government affairs team. Mr. Chair, I'm going to be very brief, and I really appreciated your overview because not only do I agree with everything that you put together, I think it speaks to the need to first start with an establishment of a common vocabulary, because oftentimes we talk colloquially about the homeowners market or the property and casualty market, but particularly for condo and townhome association entities, they're not purchasing insurance in the same market as someone who owns their own home would be purchasing their insurance themselves. And so if members can see the presentation, and I think our slides were in the packets.
Mr. Brickwood, I'm going to just interrupt you for just a second. Members, there is in your packets as well a few slides that Mr. Brickwood will be going through. And if you care to follow along, they are, again, are in your packets. Mr. Brickwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Associations typically are purchasing their insurance products in the commercial market, so in a separate market from where people who own their own single-family homes are purchasing their policies. And that commercial market is exempt from filing requirements at the Commerce Department, which means that in practical terms, we don't regulate that market in the same way that we do the property casualty market more broadly. And that really limits our ability to review how many different policies are available in the market for associations to buy and to even know how many carriers are even selling in that market. I'd also add that that means that associations often or really fall into a gap in the state's insurer of last resort system. So associations have limited options to turn to, unlike a individual homeowner who could obtain a policy from the FAIR plan if they're not able to purchase a product in the admitted market. And so what we think we are seeing, we're trying to establish the data to really track in a more detailed way, is that we may be seeing some associations having to turn to what's called the excess market, to our surplus lines market, where the state has no regulatory authority, and that can lead to price increases. There's no guarantee fund protection if there's an insolvency, and we're not able to act on consumer complaints. Residents, as Chair O'Driscoll stated, can also separately purchase HO6 policies, which we do get filed with us and have the ability to look at. And Mr. Chair, happy to talk about this in more, but I think we'd like to partner with policymakers to try to make sure that more condo and townhome residents are in good HO6 policies, because they can provide some measure of protection for what you described, where there may be an unexpected set of expenses for everyone who lives in that association, where they are hit by dues or expenses, or assessments, excuse me. Can go to the next slide. I will note Commerce was a member of the Legislative Task Force on the Long-Term Stability of Affordable Housing, and we did monitor the Common Interest Community Working Group, and so we've been providing technical assistance to legislators who are working on the bills that are coming out of those places. So happy to talk about them if you would like. I'd also note that we have been hearing from residents of condo and townhome associations pretty regularly. The stories are pretty similar, just the numbers tend to change. And I put in our data from our Consumer Services Center on complaints for the last 3 years. These are closed investigations, so it doesn't include any active investigations that we have going, but you can see that there has been a pretty significant jump in what we have seen from consumers and what we've been able to look at. I'll note that that includes a combination of complaints about HO6 policies and association policies and activities. So, Mr. Chair, we will be around for questions. Happy to be a participant in the discussion and look forward to working with all of you as we try to figure out opportunities for Minnesotans who live in these communities to have more predictable expenses with their insurance.
Deputy Commissioner, I do have some questions to kind of help supplement the conversation based on what you've put out here, and we'll certainly go to member questions if we have them. I want to go back to your first slide, if Mr. Smith could just move back. When we talk about the different kinds of policies that are here, I want to just explain to people, a named peril policy means that it's not covered unless it's actually listed in the policy. So it has to say hail, right? It has to say fire in the policy, so the perils are named in there. When we talk about the FAIR plan, this is if you are not able to get insurance for your property in any other way, in what I call the conventional insurance market. These structures are typically older structures that may have some structural issues or other limitations because of the design of them, and so they don't fall into the current model policies that Commerce would receive and end up approving. The question I want to ask on this is, how much are we seeing a contraction in the marketplace with the HOA policies that people are filing to withdraw or to leave the state of Minnesota, leaving homeowners associations with fewer options? Could you talk about the history of where that's at? And those who are filing to leave, have they shared with you why they're leaving?
Mr. Chairman, an excellent question. And if we were talking about the homeowners market exclusively, I think I'd be able to answer your question. But the challenge that we have for condo and townhome associations is that because they're purchasing their products in the commercial market, we don't have a requirement in Minnesota that they make those filings with us. So we don't have strong data to be able to answer that question specifically about how many carriers are selling in the market, what products are they actively marketing to associations specifically. I think anecdotally, we know the market is hard and has gotten harder over the last couple of years. We know that because of the stories that we hear in our Consumer Services Center, and I think many members around this table have heard from their constituents who live in condo and townhome associations. We know that associations have been facing price increases in terms of their premiums. We know that associations have been having to make choices about deductible amounts to try to moderate premium increases. And we think, but we don't know for certain, that some associations have had to turn to the surplus and excess market for coverage because they have not been able to find an insurer in the admitted market to take their property on. But we don't have a definitive answer to the question that you posed, Mr. Chair, which I think is a problem, and it's because of the nature of how we have a more limited regulatory view into the commercial market than we do into other markets that we regulate.
So, Mr. Brickwitty, when you are the department is reviewing filings from the HOA master insurance policies, are you seeing a way to try to keep those affordable that the deductibles are increasing in there and the like, and that may be causing more assessments back on the HO6 policies?
Well, Mr. Chair, so we see the HO6 policies. I brought it as a prop. I think what we would be really interested in talking about with policymakers is how do we make sure that every resident of a condo or a townhome has one of these policies. I think they are a mechanism to help protect Minnesotans from unexpected cost increases, not just in terms of what it is covering as an insurance policy itself, but also because they oftentimes have contract language about protections for unexpected assessments, like the ones that associations sometimes have had to levy on their residents because of increases in the association's insurance costs. And it's a really difficult place for an association to find itself because they're, you know, an association has pretty limited opportunities to raise revenue, if you will, to cover unexpected costs other than an assessment. So I don't think we've seen anything really significant in the HO6 coverage environment. I think we've heard from some people about having to having some premium increases or maybe managing their deductibles a little bit, but not anything, to my knowledge, from our team that differs from what we've seen in other HO 1, 2, 3, 4 through 8 policy types. But what I think we are hearing quite a bit about, though, is the challenges for the associations itself, which are not buying in one of these policies, but rather purchasing a commercial product.
Mr. Brickwoody, we do have a couple of other member questions, but I think it's important that I make one more comment, and then I've got a follow-up on that. So what people also need to realize is that within the association, they elect a board of directors, so they're actually like a little city, if you will. So you have a chair and a vice chair and a treasurer, and the association passes rules and regulations that govern the activities in that condo. And they will also review the contracts and approve the contracts and the like. And so I think that that's important to understand. They may also employ a property management company because they don't have the expertise and wherewithal within the members and the owners, members of the board who are the owners of the properties, to be able to properly execute all the duties that need to be done. Why I ask that is one of the things that the association would be saying is our carrier is no longer going to be in the state of Minnesota. They're filing to leave. We've got to find another carrier. Can you quantify how many policies in the association world, the master contracts that you might have approved, and now today, March 12th, 2024, we're down to this number, or we're stabilized at this number, to give the committee some kind of an idea of what the current market looks like for options for the association?
Mr. Chair, no, because again, commercial policies are exempt from the filing requirements in 70A.06. And so we don't have that quantification and have to rely on sort of the reports of associations to tell us that they're having difficulty obtaining insurance and that they're having trouble, or their agents are having trouble finding companies that are willing to give them bids. So I would be able to answer that question for you, again, on the single family home side, but on the condo and townhome association, I can't. And I would also add, and Mr. Chair, I think one of our sort of strong recommendations to the committee is to maybe have the insurers of last resort come and visit with the committee in an informational capacity, because condos and townhome associations fall into a gap in the state's insurer of last resort system. So you can't go to the FAIR Plan and get an HO6 policy as an individual, and an association can't go to the FAIR Plan to obtain a commercial policy. Now, I'm not suggesting that the department is endorsing that you should either one, but I think it's important for members to understand what those insurers of last resort are set up to do, what they're set up not to do presently, and then that's information that you all can evaluate about whether or not that's something that we might want to take a look at as a state to provide more of a net for people in the space, because currently there is nowhere in the admitted market for them to go.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwoody. And you've used the term admitted market. Let me just define that real quick for folks. It means that an insurance company has applied to the state of Minnesota to get an insurance company license to be able to sell insurance products in the state of Minnesota. We'll just leave it at that. There's a lot of other tiering, but they have been granted a license to be able to offer products. And of course, the people who represent the company known as insurance agents also have to be licensed. Mr. Brickwoody, we have a couple of questions right now. Representative Elkins, followed by Representative Van Binsbergen. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. A question, is there such a thing as an insurance product that would allow an individual unit owner to get coverage for their share of a potential hailstorm dame claim or assessment that would be assessed to the all of the owners in the event of, say, a big hailstorm?
Mr. Brickwoody.
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, I think in certain cases, your HO6 policy, so that policy that an individual resident can buy, will cover damage to their own individual property if it's, you know, inside their home, if it's damaged in that storm. An HO6 policy also can, not all of them do, but it can have coverage for an assessment increase that may be resulting from the association needing to make structural repairs to all of the buildings in there. So I think a partial yes. I don't think, with some small exceptions potentially, if it's an association made up of single-family homes, could you purchase a policy to specifically cover your portion of a shared roof in the event that it was damaged by hail or other peril?
Representative Elkins, follow-up.
Just an observation, I guess, more that, you know, I took this topic on because I was getting complaints from homeowners associations in my district that, you know, since the 2013 hailstorm, which generated like $13 billion in claims or something like that, that they can't get HO6 policies at all. Or if they do, they're going directly to somebody like Lloyd's of London and they're paying four times what they had paid before. And, you know, and explorations with the industry, it appeared to be that of course the root cause is climate change. We didn't used to have $13 billion hailstorms. The problem was being exacerbated by the retreat of reinsurers from the marketplace, even though the reinsurers, by all accounts, are adequately capitalized to provide it, but just that the risks and the lack of predictability had become so severe. So that's the angle I've been working on, but this is a very serious issue, and I know in my district it's top of mind for a lot of people. So I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for kicking off this discussion.
Representative Elkins, again, I just want to emphasize that it's not just the CIC properties that are affected by this. It would be multifamily that's affected by this. It would be co-ops that are affected by this. And, of course, the individual market where you own your own home, you'd be affected by this as well. And there isn't anyone in this room that hasn't seen their insurance premiums go up. And I'm trying to figure out the root cause of why that's happening and areas that we can look at to try to shore those things up to keep policies affordable. Representative Elkins.
To that point, Mr. Chair, I mean, in my conversations with, say, the Multifamily Housing Association as well, they're citing this as one of the big reasons why, in addition to interest rates and employment costs, why we've suddenly seen the apartment market, which had been going gangbusters, is suddenly ground to a halt right now. This is one of the major contributing factors.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. To Representative Elkins' point about buying an HO6 policy, that is something that the association is going to say yes or no by law. You have to have and you have to provide proof that you have the insurance. I'll guarantee if you have that financed, just like you do with your home, they're going to check to make sure you're paying your property taxes, and they're going to check to make sure you have insurance to protect the lender in those kinds of situations. Representative Van Binsbergen, followed by Representative Herr, and then Representative Ryer. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a kind of question, comment. Back to what's driving these. First of all, I appreciate your comments and your concern. I think you're really right, spot on, Representative Elkinson. What is what's driving these companies out of Minnesota? Is it claims? Is it liability claims? I'm assuming that's got a lot to do with it. You know, and I'm in the housing business also in my business world. We are having a really challenging time finding insurance for our apartment buildings, and rates have been going through the roof. I mean. We've been increasing deductibles and we've got properties that aren't even having any claims and companies are just bailing. So it's a real concern for multifamily housing. But back to the association, when rates rise for the association, obviously that bill isn't, there's not a master owner, one owner to an association, it's a whole bunch, of people that live in the dwelling. So ultimately, yeah, there's a board that makes a decision, but that rate obviously gets passed on to the person, the homeowner in a dwelling. And, you know, so I am concerned about that as well. And do you think most, I guess, so it was more of a comment. My question is do most banks, most associations, do they require HO6 policies? I mean, is that a pretty much a standard thing that's going on out there so the dwellings themselves are covered?
Representative Van, thank you, Representative Van Binsberg and Commissioner Brickwitty.
Mr. Chair and Representative, a great question. I think many associations do require now an HO6 policy for residents or for transactions. I don't think that's universally required. It's not statutorily required, so I think there are some circumstances where that may not be the case. I wouldn't want to speak on behalf of, you know, the banks or the mortgage originators, but I think you've articulated, I think, what is one of the real primary concerns about insurance becoming less affordable or less accessible for someone who wants to move into any kind of home, association, or in a single family home. Because if you can't document in that real estate transaction that you have insurance coverage on the front end, then it becomes near impossible for you to complete that transaction. I think to your comments about what's driving issues in this market, I think it's a combination of things. I think Representative Elkins articulated very well what many of the risks are and what's sort of at the root cause of what's happening in our market. And I'd defer to Mr. Cocking to speak on behalf of the insurance companies. He can, you know, on behalf of his members, can describe their business decisions, I think, much better than I can. But I think there are things that are somewhat unique to the association and the condo association and townhome association markets. I think there is a risk concentration for those types of properties that's a little bit different than you would see in single family homes across the entire state. So when you have a hailstorm like we had on August 11th of 2023, where I was on an airplane at the airport that took off through that hailstorm, so I remember it extremely well. That comes through and hits a lot of condo and townhome associations. That's a lot of roof that has a lot of hail exposure for what was a 20, 25-minute storm through the Twin Cities area. That became a billion-dollar weather event in that half an hour, and we're seeing more expensive storms more frequently. And I think we would be interested in working with you on making sure that residents in these spaces know what are some things that they can do to make themselves more resilient so that they can stay safe and healthy in their homes. And we can also reduce some of that risk exposure so insurers are able to still sell and write in this market and they have lower risk exposure when they do.
Representative Binsberg, and follow-up?
No, thank you, sir.
Representative Herr, followed by Representative Ryer. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is, I'm new to this topic, but I have actually been a townhome owner in the past. And so I had no idea that as an owner, you could even buy your own individual. I'm a little bit challenged with this conversation because I looked up, since I don't know this well, is what a last resort, insurer of last resort is. And it says that it is a state-backed program that provides coverage to individuals or businesses who cannot obtain insurance from private insurers, often due to being considered high risk. And I guess what confuses me about this is that a home in a townhome association or in a condo is at no higher risk than an individual home. So I guess I don't understand then why, one, that it is considered high risk and that there aren't products to be able to purchase. And two, I guess, and this is maybe something that you, maybe I can have a better conversation with you offline, but I just want to understand better this industry. And is it just because purely that the townhome, the associations, the condos, because it is commercial, there's a very little data that we can see about what is happening with the industry, which makes it easier to have these things happening? Because I'm really troubled with, like, when we do insurance and risk and risk analysis and we're pooling risk. A townhome is at no greater risk of this big, you know, hail situation as an individual home, and yet I can buy insurance as an individual homeowner. And so I don't know if maybe you can even comment on that. Maybe it's just for me saying this out loud because it just doesn't even make financial sense to me, or it doesn't make logical sense to me. And secondly, what I would like to know is, have we had a report out from this legislative task force on long-term stability on affordable housing? Have we had a report back on this group and what their findings were so that maybe we can get that out to committee members who haven't been on this committee before?
Deputy Commissioner Berkwitty.
Mr. Chair, Representative, sorry, I'm trying to see you through the trees. I think an excellent set of questions. I would encourage you to pose them to Mr. Cocking as well. Because I think he can speak more plainly than I could about sort of what the companies are seeing and how they're making business decisions to offer products or not. I would agree with you about there's nothing inherently, you know, I think there is a some, as I said to Representative Van Binsberg, there's some unique geography to where condo and townhome associations tend to be located in our state relative to the spread of where single family homes are. But aside from that, I think to your point about the insurers of last resort, I would define them slightly differently. I think those are the places where Minnesotans can go to obtain insurance for either themselves or their business if they can't get insurance anywhere else. I think the challenge that we have for this particular market segment is that condo and townhome associations don't fit into one of those categories, so they can't get insurance from one of those insurers of last resort. So there's a hole in that safety net, if you will, specific to condo and townhome associations, because the commercial market that they purchase in is not covered by one of the other insurers of last resort. So I think that's something that the committee could consider and think about and hear from the insurers of last resort themselves, which are quasi state entities, and they could speak to that. That is not exclusively true in every state. Other states have made other public policy choices. To your question about the reports, yes, there was a report and recommendations from the Legislative Task Force on the Long-Term Stability of Affordable Housing. Representative Howard was the House co-chair on that proposal. It's available, I believe, on the LCC website. There were two insurance-related recommendations that came out of that related to commerce and Minnesota housing working together to share data on what's happening for affordable housing providers, which is a similar sort of story, but probably a different set of public policy solutions because they're different kind of housing providers than what we're talking about here today. And there was also recommendations that came out of the work group from on common interest communities, and Representative Bonner has a bill that has, I think, already been through its first committee stop has a number of the recommendations in coming forward through the legislature this year from that group.
Representative, her follow-up.
Mr. Chair, is it possible for our CAs to maybe get those two particular recommendations on insurance out to the entire committee so that people can have that at their fingertips? If you're all like me, you'll never go back and look at it because you got a million things on your plate right now. So if we could just maybe have those links sent out to our committee members.
Representative Herr, absolutely. And as you are aware, because I've asked you before, I would like to have a subcommittee of people from this committee taking a look at that and working with the industry and gathering more information from that housing report and how it affects the insurance area, not necessarily the housing committee because they have their work, but we are the insurance part of that equation so that we can be better informed on that. Representative Herr.
Mr. Chair, just one comment to sort of end my piece of this is that when I lived in a townhouse, it was not in the state of Minnesota here. But what I will say is that I have worked with individuals who live in townhomes or condos that have associations, and I am challenged with understanding some of these fees are enormous. When I looked at trying to purchase my home probably about 6 years ago, I also looked at condos and townhouses because my husband no longer wanted to shovel or mow the lawn, which is totally fine. And when I looked at what they were charging, it was a third of, like, if I would have just bought my own house, the cost was a third of what my total cost of my housing would have been, and it cost me more to actually buy a cheaper townhouse or condo in one of these associations. It cost me more in my monthly mortgage plus this fee than for me to buy a house that was $100,000 more than that townhouse would have been, although that meant my husband would have to mow and shovel. But it's free labor to me. And so I was challenged in understanding that, like, if as a homeowner, if something happens to my property, I know I'm assessing that risk and I'm saving for it, right? But if you're part of an association and they tell you that there are all these things that are included, but what I found out from many, many homeowners in these situations is that they ended up, not only were they paying these absorbent fees, but then when something would happen to their unit, they still were out of pocket a ton of money. I worked with a particular group who they had to replace all of their windows, and it cost them millions of dollars. And had these individuals known, like, there were so many things that were not covered by this association that they themselves could have planned for it. But I guess I'm challenged with how this industry is running, and that someone says they're responsible for certain things, and then something happens and they say, well, it's too high risk, or this actually, there's like these little nuances that they point to as to why they don't. And the homeowner themselves now have not, through the years, saved the monies they might have done had it been a single family home for themselves to prepare for some of these costs. And I feel like we have created this cycle of where it is impossible for a homeowner to actually accurately anticipate what they should save, what they should do, and yet they're paying these huge amounts of fees into these condos and these associations. And so I'm very much interested in really understanding more about this, because the lack of transparency has made it very difficult for us to actually be supportive and helpful in this particular industry. So thank you for letting me make those comments.
Representative Hurd, two things on them. We do have someone who's going to be testifying from the Association Institute, and maybe can shed some light on that later to this morning. And an association that is doing its job is actually collecting money on a monthly basis for roof replacement, so you don't have those larger assessments and the carpet in the common areas and all of those different kinds of things, so that as those improvements need to be done, we don't have additional assessments on the unit owners over and above what we were just talking about, perhaps for a deductible, because that's not covered for replacement of sidewalks and carpets and those kinds of things. So that's why we're having this conversation, because it's been around this committee for, you know, a few years on the discussion. Representative Ryer, and then that was the last member question I have, and then I think we're going to move to Mr. Conking after that. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. Appreciate it. Piggybacking a bit off of Lead Her's comments, I've been sitting here thinking about what I would advise a constituent if they were looking at purchasing in a place that had a homeowners association, a condo, or a townhome. And I was struck by the whole concept that the HO6 should link up with the master contract. Should a consumer be studying the master contract and really understanding it? If they were looking at two different properties, is there one that would be much worse for them than the other based on that contract? And how would they know? And then I have one other quick follow-up. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think a really great question. And let me preface all this by saying that I am happy to come and meet with any of you in your office, in your district, to hear from constituents. Many of you have connected us with residents of condo and townhome associations that live in your communities. So I'm happy to be in the car all summer and driving around the state, coming to visit. We'd very much like to hear directly from consumers who are in these communities to understand exactly what they're facing and what questions they have. Representative, I'd recommend two things. I do think if I were personally looking at buying a condo or a townhome association, I would probably be asking a lot of questions about the insurance policies that are in place. I would be in really good conversation with my insurance agent and my real estate agent. I think the insurance agents in particular have been a tremendous resource to the department in understanding what is happening for their clients, both residents who have been in their homes in a condo or a townhome for years or decades, and also people who are looking to make purchases. And I would be asking questions not only about, you know, what kind of insurance coverage can I get for my belongings, my personal possessions inside
my home, and I think that would be true if I was looking to rent an apartment as well, too, because renter's insurance, which is a different HO number, but also similarly important. I would be asking questions of the association that I'd be looking to purchase into to understand what's in their policy now, what have their cost trends looked like, have they had recent assessments or assessments sort of looking back 5-10 years, and if so, on what, to kind of get a sense of what my own individual risk exposure might be like to some of those unexpected costs. I don't think that's dissimilar from the advice that I would give to somebody looking to buy a single family home, but I think historically, you know, people looking to downsize or looking to move into a condo or townhome so that you can reduce your own individual labor from the things that are commonly covered in those living situations, like, tends to, I think, cause people to think that there might not be individual responsibility for something that insurance would typically cover, because it's going to be covered by the association. And I think what we've seen in Minnesota over the last couple of years is that there have been significant financial exposures that people have found to be very unexpected. And I think your question is a really, really good one for people who are looking to move into those settings to be asking on the front end so that they can take steps to make sure that they have appropriate coverage, or they go in knowing that this is something that could happen later on.
Representative Iyer, you said you had a follow-up as well?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Different question. It seems like there's a gap in oversight of commercial policies, and I'm wondering if that's overseen elsewhere. The header on page 2 says the Commerce Department has limited regulatory oversight over commercial policies. Who's overseeing it for Minnesota?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chair, Representative, Commerce is the state's insurance regulator. 70A.06 is a statute. That statute is not the same in every single state. Other states have made different public policy choices relative to how they regulate their commercial market. That's a public policy decision.
Representative Iyer, I want to just provide for the committee some clarification on your question about where does an individual get the information. Under Minnesota Common Interest Community Law, if you and I sign a purchase agreement, I'm the seller, you're the buyer, you have the right to receive what's called a disclosure, which includes the financial condition. So you'll be able to see how much money is in reserve, what the monthly association fees are, what the association can assess back for, a copy of the rules and the regulations of the association, and all of these documents. And as you review them, you have 10 days. You can back out of your purchase agreement if you don't like what you see in there. So Minnesota law does take care of the consumer from that standpoint. The problem is, just like everything else, do you take the time as the prospective purchaser to go through the documents, whether it be the purchase of a car or the purchase of a commons community property or any type of purchase, do you take the time to go through to know what it is that you're purchasing? It's always after the fact. Oh, I didn't know. And I suspect that that's where Mr. Brickwitty's PowerPoints, where he's getting some of the complaints that they're talking about, is post-purchase. I didn't know this. And you can go right back to the docs and go, it says right here, you signed that you got them and you went through with the purchase. I'm not blaming the consumer, but I'm just saying the consumer does have, and that has over the years increased and protected the consumer since 1994 when we first incorporated this law. Representative Iyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, which to me also leads to the people taking the time, but also being able to understand the rather dense prose in some of these documents. And I'm wondering if we have or could talk about plain language expectations for documentation that would be consumer-facing.
Do you want Mr. Brickwitty to address that, or you want me, or is it just a rhetorical question this morning? I'll answer this in the interest of time, and because I want to bring Mr. Haynes and Mr. Cocking up and have them present, and then we can follow up questions on those folks. This is an expansive topic. This isn't the end-all, be-all conversation. If there's improvements that need to be done in the market, we should work with the people who are out there, who hear this, and look at putting some reasonable things in if it's necessary. But again, I want to make sure that we understand that there are these disclosures that are out there and there are these types of things. It's whether an individual picks up at this point and decides if they want to dig into it. I personally, maybe I'm the exception to the rule, but if I'm going to have a 30-year mortgage, I'm responsible for paying that and tied to that property. I'm going to look at everything on that. What's the cost of insurance? What's my cost of repair? What is, you know, if it's a particular, if it's a condo, what are the rules and regulations? I'm tied in to have to live by that. And if I turn around and sell it, the buyer's going to get updated records. And there's a regulation on how dated that those records can be as well. Right? I mean, there's a time frame. You can't say, well, back 7 years ago, here's what it was. No, those are real-time records that we're looking at. So there's certainly room for the committee to be educated. Yeah. Mr. Percuti and Mr. Smith, thank you. We'll ask you to stand by. There may be some other questions. And with that, I'm going to bring Mr. Cocky and Mr. Haynes up, and we'll have both those gentlemen present, and then we will take member questions at that time for the remainder of the time that we have for committee this morning. Mr. Cocky, Mr. Haynes, welcome. Mr. Cocking, you were next on our list. I think we'll have you go first. Have you identify yourself for the record, and then go ahead and proceed with your comments and testimony this morning. Mr. Cocking.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Aaron Cocking. I'm the president and CEO of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. We're the voice of the property casualty industry here in Minnesota. Certainly appreciate the opportunity to appear before the committee, talk about the insurance costs in this space. Certainly people are concerned about the rising cost of insurance, not only in this space, but kind of across the board. Certainly talked to several of you about this over the past couple of years, certainly conversations with Representative Elkins, the interest that he's had in this and trying to address some of these concerns. I guess the starting point is, amidst all of the conversations and questions about what is happening, this really does boil down to the fact that premiums are increasing because of the rising cost of claims. Insurers work hard to predict the losses they'll face each year, but when those actual losses exceed those predictions, premiums have to rise to cover those differences. I hear from people who have said, well, I've never had a claim, and it isn't fair that I have to pay more as a result of this. And I have to remind people that insurance is not a savings account. The risk is spread to the entire pool and priced accordingly. So from my perspective, there's really three main factors at play right now. And some of these are the same across the board, whether we're talking home, condo, HOA. But I think it's important to talk about this, and then I'm happy to entertain questions. So the first is inflation. The cost of materials used to repair and replace damaged parts of a structure has surged. And while inflation's cooled slightly, and we saw additional information come out this morning about that fact, the insurance industry does tend to adjust more slowly. That's because rates are still being set at the higher cost of these materials. You add to that the uncertainty around the recent tariffs announced by the Trump administration. It certainly inserted some price uncertainty into the cost of lumber and other materials imported from places like Canada. And this is all happening while insurers are trying to rebuild in places like the Carolinas, the coastal parts of the Southeast, and the California, which had wildfires, obviously, that we're well aware of, that destroyed numerous properties there. So that's first. The second, obviously, is weather losses, and we've had a great deal of conversation in this committee the last couple years on this. Minnesota does stand out as one of the most challenging states when it comes to weather-related losses. We're experiencing stronger, more severe storms and larger, more destructive weather events, leading to substantial damages that insurers have to cover. The New York Times story from last May highlighted that Minnesota was one of only five, was the only state where insurers had lost money in each of the previous 5 years. So insurers are doing everything they can to stay in the market, which includes raising rates and adjusting coverage options, increasing deductibles. I often say that the only thing worse than unaffordable insurance is unavailable insurance, and that's something that we certainly saw play out in places like California. Unfortunately, we've had a growing chorus of bad actors that are still taking advantage of our severe weather, despite the significant reforms this committee advanced in the last couple of years. Roofing contractors are greatly inflating the cost of roof repairs. Insurers have to pay those inflated costs, and those are passed along to policyholders in the form of higher premiums. When you boil it all down, these higher insurance premiums are the direct price we're all paying for climate change. And the third is legal system abuse. The legal landscape is a significant driver of rising premiums, especially in the space that we're talking about today. There are several cases that have raised alarms amongst insurers, especially as plaintiffs' attorneys develop legal theories that increase exposure in this sector. For example, building owners can be held liable for incidents on their property, even if they involve criminal acts. Imagine a situation where someone enters a building, attacks a resident, and the resident sues the property owner for not maintaining a safe and secure environment. Similar case to that in Georgia occurred a few years back, which resulted in a jury award of almost $70 million. And while I won't comment on whether that was a fair verdict or not, the $70 million was likely covered by insurance, which then has to be factored into the rates that we all pay. Additionally, we've seen a rapid uptick in lawsuits and payouts from the surge of new businesses that deliver to homes and apartments, such as Amazon, DoorDash, Grubhub, Shipt, Uber. More traffic in these spaces than we've ever seen before. And that additional traffic leads to additional accidents and losses such as slip and falls. And again, that those losses and that exposure has to be figured into premiums. And all of those foregoing reasons have been enough to scare numerous insurers out of this line of business, especially. We all remember from Econ 101 that that fewer options generally means higher prices. So we need to be doing all we can to make Minnesota a more appealing place for insurers that want to do business and operate in our state. And with that, I'll stop, and I'm happy to answer what I know are kind of a myriad of questions. So,
Mr. Haynes, we'll have you go ahead and provide your testimony, and then we'll let members go back and forth between their questions for the two of you. Mr. Haynes, welcome to the committee. If you'll identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony this morning. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Patrick Hines with Messerly Kramer. I represent the Community Associations Institute Minnesota chapter. CAI is a trade organization representing the interests of homeowner associations from the residents and board members to property managers and the contractors who work with them. I want to thank you for having this conversation. I think it's very important. I took a lot of notes, and I'll try to adjust my comments to maybe answer some questions on the way. Just as a baseline, when you're hearing from your residents...
Sorry, we have you come a little closer. I'll pull the microphone. There you go.
Sorry. Just as a baseline number, you're hearing from your residents more frequently probably. The HOA task force estimates that there are approximately 8,500 associations in Minnesota now, and over 1.2 million Minnesota residents live in them. That's a big number, and so these issues are coming to the fore in part because there are so many more people living in associations. I also think there was the number put out during the the working group conversations that upwards of 80% of new construction occurs within a homeowner association now. So you are seeing many more associations in suburbs and exurbs, which if you were to drive by, just look like a traditional single family home subdivision, but are actually in HOAs. And so I think those factors contribute a lot to why we are hearing from more and more constituents about issues. Just a couple baseline points about associations. We say association in the same way we say corporation or business or department. But it's important to remember an association is simply the residents, your constituents who live within that building or that neighborhood. They own that property, they own the common elements jointly together. They don't make money, they don't sell things, they don't raise capital. They simply are operating as neighbors. And the board members are the residents. So the lady down the hall with the Pomeranian might be your board chair. The family two floors down with the four kids who wake you up at night, they may be on the board too. So it can be a struggle for volunteer board members to tackle these issues that even all of us at the legislature have trouble tackling. They are governed by MCIOWA, Minnesota Common Interest Ownership Act. I'll just point out a few requirements that I think have some bearing on this. First, associations are required to carry required by state law to carry insurance, so there's not really an option to not carry it. Obviously, that would be a terrible option anyway. I'm certainly not advising that. It also requires the association to promptly repair or replace all damages for the common elements. So, like at my house, I've got a damaged window, and I decided that maybe I'll worry about that later. I live in my own house, so I can do that. The association doesn't really have that ability. They really need to be proactively repairing damage as it occurs, and that can lead to more claims, higher costs for the association members. Also, when you are aware of damage or repair, that becomes something that has to be disclosed to potential buyers. That can create problems if you're involved in construction defect litigation, where it becomes very difficult for members of associations to sell their units if they want to move because of a job or they get married or something like that. When these defects get tied up for a period of time, it brings sales to a halt a lot of times, which creates even more problems for the association. They pay for the insurance, as Representative O'Driscoll mentioned, through their annual assessments, which are paid by your monthly dues. Annual assessments, it is simply a calculation of the cost the association expects for the year, and then you divide that by primarily the number of units. You may have a division based on the size of units if you have varying sizes, but that's what the annual assessment is. So if the dues are high at a particular association, you really need to look at what services they're providing. Some associations have very few common elements. Others might have a swimming pool. They may maintain a park, snow removal, road replacement, all of those things. So the fees that you pay on a monthly basis will vary greatly between associations. And that's why, again, as Chair O'Driscoll pointed out, if you're buying into an association, please take advantage of the 10-day right of rescission period that you have, where you have all of the documents given to you to review. And to Representative Ryer's question, yes, you should review the master association policy. And if you have an association that is professionally managed, I would be very surprised if you weren't receiving some notice when it comes to renewal saying, at least saying, our association policy covers X. The loss assessment piece is really critical because that can change, especially as premiums go up. Premiums go up, you look for other ways to save costs. So last year, the loss assessment might have a $10,000 deductible. This year, it might have a $100,000 deductible, which means if an association has a covered loss and they pay $400,000 to repair roofs, that $100,000 has to be paid by the association, which means it has to be paid by the members. If you have an HO6 policy that has that loss assessment in place, if it's enough, hopefully you're covered. If you haven't made sure it aligns, you may have an HO6 policy where you're still going to be on the hook for a $5,000 special assessment. So it's confusing, but critically important for homeowners to look at that so they understand what they might be on the hook for. One other point, too, and then I think we just go to questions since there's so many. The reserves. Representative O'Driscoll mentioned reserves. State law requires associations to put money aside in a reserve account to pay for replacement of roofs, replacement of windows, driveways, things like that. By state law, that money is required to be set aside in a separate account and only used for the replacement of those elements. So if your insurance premiums jump 100% and you can't take money out of that reserve account to cover the insurance premiums. So even an association that's doing a good job maintaining a reserve account does not have the flexibility necessarily to take funds from that account to pay for the insurance increase, even if that would make reasonable sense from a business standpoint and just trying to manage your costs. And finally, I think I said finally once already, I apologize. Assessment increases. A lot of associations have declarations or bylaws that prohibit or cap an increase in annual assessments. It might be a cap of 3% or 5%. That can put a board in a very difficult position if their costs are increasing, not just on insurance, but on other inflationary pressures, and their budget is now in excess of what they can assess to their members. They're really stuck in a difficult position and have to make decisions about how much insurance we're going to get, what's the deductible going to be, what's the loss assessment, whether we go to the secondary market, and all of those things that have been discussed. So at the end of the day, this conversation is critically important because these costs come down, really not to the association, but to the residents of that association, your constituents, the ones that you're hearing from. So I'm very happy to be part of the conversation, and I'll answer any questions to the best of my ability. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. And Mr. Kocky, Mr. Haynes, we have a couple of member questions. We'll start with Representative Dotseff, followed by Representative Herr. Representative Dotseff.
Thank you, Chair Driscoll. Testifiers, most of my questions were answered at the end. I think you really captured talking about the reserves. And really, I encourage purchasers to really look and see how much are actually put in the reserves when they're actually making that acquisition. You've got that 10-day right of rescission, which is important. I think that was covered as well. But a quick question for Mr. Cocking would be, do you sense that maybe trends are changing a little bit where it used to be, I'll just go back to our parent era, where they would always look at replacing the roof themselves, they budget for that roof. Do you find that even not just in HOAs, but insurance in general, where people tend to almost just wait for that next hailstorm to get a replacement of a roof instead of realizing that that roof has a life expectancy of, I'll just say, 20 years?
Mr. Kocky.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dotseff, 100%. I talk about this all the time. Nobody, it doesn't seem like anybody in Minnesota, maybe across the country, except for a select few, budget for the fact that they're going to have to eventually replace their roof. Everybody assumes that in the 20 or 30 year course of their roof, that at some point we're going to get a hailstorm, you're going to end up with damage, and your insurance company is going to cover that. I think we're seeing a little bit of a change in that because insurers are trying to take steps to make sure that they can remain in the market. And one of the things that you've seen a number of insurers do is move away from replacement cost coverage, which would basically be full. You have hail damage, even if your roof is 20 years, 30 years old, it doesn't have much life left on it. Hailstorm comes, insurance company pays to completely re-roof it. A lot of companies have moved to an actual cash value once you get over a roof that's over 10 years old. And I think that's the fairer way to kind of everybody that pays premiums. I mean, the more of those costs that we can take off the shoulders of the other policyholders is a good thing. We need to encourage people, and there's so much of this conversation that can be around consumer education, because I think that's one of the things that's consistently highlighted in the course of this discussion, is that consumers generally don't know. And this is one of the things we need to educate people on, is that part of owning a home and having a roof is potentially setting aside resources for the inevitable, which is one of those being a replacement of a roof.
Representative Dotseff.
Thank you.
Representative Herr, followed by Representative Katiza Watena. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure which testifier maybe this should go to. Good to see you again, Mr. Cocking.
I'm moving out of the way so I can see you. That's
just a quick question. I know we talked a lot about the consumer education piece of it, but I just wanted to understand when an individual is looking to buy one of these units or one of these, you know, condos or townhouses, when are they given this master policy? Do either of you know?
Ms. Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Lead Her. I believe you would get, you're entitled to review the association documents when you sign a purchase agreement, and then you have 10 days, and if you rescind, then your earnest money is returned. So the document should be available at that time. I would have to double check to see if a list includes that document where you would be given that at that moment, as opposed to, you would certainly be given the declaration, the bylaws, the rules and regulations. I would have to check to see if a copy of the master document would typically be included. It should.
Representative Herr, I can answer that for you. You get a reference that there is coverage and then who the carrier is as a part of the disclosure. But it's then up to the homeowner and they're part of their due diligence if they're visiting with their insurance agent to find out what kind of an HO policy they want to buy so that it dovetails into the master policy contract and provides them the best coverage or that they avoid any kind of gaps on there. So they don't actually get the physical insurance contract, but it's certainly something that is available and they can have follow-up. That's the whole idea of the disclosure, is to raise the questions to inform the consumer to do their due diligence. Representative Herr.
And are these documents, Mr. Chair and testifiers, are these documents public documents that someone could find as they were looking at homes. And the reason why I'm asking this is we're talking about this circular argument of people needing to be more educated, but then we don't provide them the tools so that they can educate themselves before they make a decision. And I just looked up, and again, I go back to this risk pool that we're talking about here. I'm looking at homes in my district, a townhouse that is comparable to the cost of my house, about $800,000. The HOA cost is $400. But I'm looking at another townhouse that is only $325,000. The HOA is $500. It's 33% of the P&I of that unit. There is no way that a consumer, and I'm a smart consumer, I've bought probably 8 different houses in 3 different states in the course of my life. There is no way for us to assume that somebody then, when we keep talking about the onus is on the consumer and them doing their due diligence, you cannot do your due diligence when the tools that you are using to compare what it is, the decisions you're going to be make about home ownership, you don't have those documents that tell you what am I paying that is 33% of my monthly cost of owning this home that's $500 versus I buy an $800,000 house and it is $500. It is impossible for anyone to do their due diligence if then they have to put an offer on a place in order then to get their documents, in order to review that and within 10 days. For anybody who has bought houses, which I think most of us have, that process in itself is already extremely difficult. And then for us to say, but we give it to you when you put in, it's too late for me. If you give it to me when I put in an agreement, it is too late. And for us to say the due, I'm going to say right now that as a person who is a first generation to own a home, to go to college, you don't know to ask what you don't know to ask when you come from a community that is not social and cultural capital. And I reject the notion of this committee stating that people should do their due diligence. As somebody who was educated and had a really strong finance background, I did my best to do my due diligence, and there were times in which I did not understand what I was getting into. I really agree with Representative Ryer's comment on plain language. On if we want people to do their job as consumers, then we need to then either the industry's going to have to step up and say, how do we make these documents public? How do we make sure that people compare apples to apples? And how do we make sure that people then can do the education that they need in order to make some of these decisions? Because I would like for the industry to do that so that I don't have to write a law to force people to do that. So those are just my comments. I think that it is important for us to talk about how it is that we have been led down this process in which people then cannot be informed consumers. Because I'm telling you now, as I'm comparing these houses in my district, there's no way for me to know any of these things before I put in an offer to decide what I have to cover. And I will say that there was a comment made that the HOA, they'll know like what they have to cover, their expenses, windows, roofs. I'm telling you right now, in each of the ones I've been to, the HOA did not make the assessment, did not plan well enough. And even in one of the HOAs, the residents told me they were told, we don't want to go into our reserves because if we use that to pay for this, to fix this thing, our insurance will go up. So now you all have to pay an additional assessment. There's so much lack of transparency in this industry. That is never what I should hear, is that we've charged you money, we've saved it away, but we're not going to use it, so we're going to do an additional assessment on you. That is unacceptable to me. So I have never been interested in this, but boy, more than ever have I decided this is what I'm going to be interested in. So thank you for letting me make those comments. I don't know if you have anything to address that, but I would appreciate just maybe some insights as to the things that I've stated.
Mr. Cocking, Mr. Hines.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Leader, a lot of great comments, a lot to unpack there. I'll say a couple of things. I think from the consumer education standpoint, I think we need to do a better job, not only when people are getting to the point where they're in the buying process. I mean, this is one of the things that we've advocated for a long time, for more of this education at the high school level. I mean, people don't know about premiums and rates and, I mean, everything else that goes along, I mean, a deductible and kind of everything else that goes along with insurance. And I think that's unfortunate because then we thrust them out into the world and you comes time to buy your first house or to buy your first condo. And to your point, Lead Her, then it's like, well, here you have 10 days to review this. And you're looking at it, and it's like, I don't know what any of this stuff means. I mean, how am I supposed to make an informed decision? Even if you gave me the information, I'm not equipped enough to be able to look at this and say, oh, yeah, this makes sense, and I'm comparing this to this, and I know the difference. And so I do think that there's an issue there. Tying into the comment that Representative Ryer had as well, You know, on personal lines policies, the law does state that they've got to be, I think it's a ninth grade reading level or something that a common person could understand. I can't remember what the exact verbiage is, but there's always been this distinction between personal lines and commercial lines policies. Personal lines, the general understanding or position of the state as far as this policy has been is that you generally write it to the lower level because you have less informed consumers, and I think that's generally true. There's always been kind of this distinction that in commercial lines, you're dealing with people that are maybe a little more sophisticated and that they can understand this because it's generally a business arrangement or transaction. And that's kind of the distinction between the two. As we get to the point, like you've got a master policy, and maybe this is some sort of blend or mix between a business entity and you know, personal lines, maybe something needs to happen there. That's an interesting conversation that I'd certainly be willing to entertain with you.
Representative Herr.
And Mr. Cocking, I'm so glad you mentioned high school education because I did have a bill to say high school finance one half a credit before you graduate. I think it is so important. But I will just state for the record that, like, on my home, which was comparable to one of these townhouses I pulled, I only pay $460 a month in insurance, in homeowner's insurance. And I want us not to be lost, for this point to be lost in us, that not only is somebody paying a $500 HOA fee, they're paying insurance, homeowners on top of that, which means that it costs me less as somebody who has a very expensive house in a very expensive district than somebody who is trying to buy an affordable unit at $325,000. It is counterintuitive to what we are trying to do to get people into affordable units. Thank you, Mr. Cocking.
Representative Herr, I want to just share some other thoughts when you were talking about comparing the two different properties that you had with the homeowners HOA on there. A couple of things to think about on there. Number one, when you were talking about they were talking about not wanting to submit the claim, and we're going to pay for it out of the reserves, we're going to do the special assessment, that wouldn't have been the insurance company. That would have been the association who's made up of the owners. So if that's not what the association wants, they vote them out just like they vote you and I in out on those kinds of things as well. Second is the costs that are built into an HOA, as a monthly association fee or assessment, those can vary from the replacement cost to, in some of these buildings, you may have concierge services or you may have ponds and trails and different things.
Not in my district.
I'm making a statement about what can impact these. I'm not doing an assessment in your district. I'm talking generally about where things are at. As I want folks walking out of here thinking that there's nefarious stuff that's intended or that's built into this, because this is a great way for people to be able to find and purchase affordable housing on either end, the entry market or for retirees. And I don't want people walking out of here thinking that these are bad properties, because they're not. There's a little glitch in the process. That's what the legislature is here to do, is to fix these kinds of things. I've also lived in a townhome in Woodbury in my life. Right. You're so fun. That's why I like you. But my point is that in these kinds of things, like where my mother lived, they had ponds and trails and stuff, and they ended up having to pay up for those kinds of things over and above the street improvements, because they were interior streets. The city wouldn't cover the sewer and water. Once it came off the public road, it was the responsibility of the association for any kinds of amenities. So those kinds of things can end up costing you additional money. Again, I'm not digging in because I don't know that. But you can also ask those questions in advance if you're doing your due diligence. You don't have to wait and say, well, I'm going to sign a purchase agreement to get this. You can start asking questions and getting that information, what's covered, what's not. And I'm 100% with you on finance and consumer advocacy in high school, because we are missing that, and that would make much better consumers for everyone. And that's why we're doing these kinds of things that we've done all along in commerce, is to be able to have that opportunity that we might have missed, so that we can make decisions for people in the state of Minnesota. I feel like I just gave a third reading speech on the floor, by the way. With that, Representative Cadiz-Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is kind of good timing, I guess. I can piggyback off of Representative Ryer's comments about the plain language. In the Children and Families Committee last session, we actually, Representative Hoden Hassan had carried a summary bill for parents whose children were entering the child protection system, foster care system, because, you know, you get this stack of pages about all the things that you need to do in order to safely be able to welcome your children back home out of the system. And so we passed a bill for a summary page. And so I'm wondering potentially if there's a way that we could work together to look at what that may look like for this situation.
Mr. Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Katiza-Watum. To that point, there's legislation coming forward through the process this session. There's a number of bills related to HOAs. Representative Bonner's bill, which I think most people just call the HOA bill, has had provisions related to plain language in it, and I know many stakeholders have been talking about it, and there is discussion about having some small appropriation to an entity who would put together the type of thing you're talking about, and you know, certainly something that CAI would be supportive of. It is important to try to make sure everyone understands as best as possible. So that is in the works.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. I think that that's really helpful. It kind of just to move on to another note, and Mr. Cocking, I know that you worked really closely with Representative Tabke last session on some of the more bad actor type bills that for the storm chasers and roof replacers and all of this sort of stuff. So I'm curious, I guess, and to the extent that the department may have any suggestions as well, if there are other types of restrictions or framework or anything that the legislature can do to kind of move people away from this idea that it's the insurance company's job to replace your roof. I think, and particularly within the HOA situation, is a little bit challenging because, again, like Representative Herr was mentioning, you're paying both insurance, but then also a fee to the HOA to kind of cover some of these things. And so the distinction, I think, between the residential compact or contract, rather, with the insurance company and then the commercial contract with the insurance company, how do those interplay, and just making sure that we can get people the right information so that they know when people are graduating from high school, graduating from college, starting off their career, starting their families, there's so much information flying at you. And to the extent that, you know, you have to have a lot of trust in your real estate agent, in your insurance agent, and all of these folks. But is there really any true, like, fiduciary duty to make sure that we're not leading the consumers astray in order to get the final signature on the bill, on the bill of sale, and on these agreements? So I'm just curious how again we can work together so that we don't necessarily have to put something in statute in order to move in the right direction.
Mr. Cocking.
Mr. Chair, Representative Katiza-Watum, great question and great points. I mean, I think that I mean, 2 years ago we took a step. Last year we took a step. We're still not there. I mean, I think building upon those. To your point about the HOAs and the kind of especially, I mean, there's been a fair number of reporting, especially from the reformer, kind of on some of the challenges that exist in this. This was highlighted last October, and I think for us what stuck up, and we ended up sending a letter to the Attorney General on this as well, that, I mean, some of this stuff should be investigated because we're all paying for it. The issue of this contractor or this property management company that was doing its own work and charging its insurance company, and they had signed an agreement with their own contractor to do work, and the date of the storm, they had signed the contract 7 days before the storm hit. So if somebody's got a crystal ball like that, maybe they should be playing the lottery instead of ripping off insurance companies. I mean, I think that's the point that, I mean, the letter we sent to Attorney General Ellison is, this looks a lot like insurance fraud. I mean, if we're paying these and we see a lot of kind of this inside self-dealing, I think that's one of the things that we should be looking at too. I mean, some of these are just simple steps. Even if there's no malfeasance, it certainly looks like there could be. And that was kind of the point that we made, and we're all paying for it. I talked to somebody recently who does a ton in this space on the insurance side, and they said, you know, generally overhead and profit that goes to contractors in most insurance work is like 10% profit, 10% overhead that the insurer pays. They say in a lot of these instances, it's like 50 to 60% overhead and profit. Some of these property management companies, from what I've been told, are making more money when hailstorms come through doing roof replacements than they do in any other part of their portfolio. And we all get to pay for it because it comes back in the form of higher insurance premiums. And so those are the things that we're interested in looking at. I mean, anybody that's got a legitimate loss, insurers should pay for, they should cover. You're never going to hear me sit up here and dispute that. But the extra stuff that goes in that we all have to pay for is stuff that we really need to look at and really need to crack down on.
Thank you, Mr. Cocking. And members, with that, we are close to the end of the committee time. And there have been a lot of these issues that have been out there that we've been undertaking that have been in the background and have been not only us, but other colleagues have been working on. And I'm glad that we have the time to be able to do it. And I really appreciate the robust and civil conversations that we've had on here. I have asked Representative Van Binsbergen, Mr. Cocking, Representative Elkins, and Lead Her. And Mr. Hines, I think I'm going to ask you if you were interested as well to sit together to have a conversation about the insurance component down here based on today's discussion to keep this going, because it's oftentimes, oh, we did that in committee, and then we're not, there's any follow through on that. So I'm hoping that we can get something worked together through that. The other thing I'm going to remind this group, because when I talked about the CIC, that went into place in 1994, June 1st of 1994. It was an utter disaster before we had these laws on the book that I was talking about and featuring at the beginning of the conversation. It's been 30 years. I suspect a few more tweaks along the way could be beneficial to all of us. And it's going to be this group that's going to be able to do it. I wanted to be in this group because it's insurance. That's our charge. I don't want other committees infringing on the jurisdiction of this committee. And with that, tomorrow is Liquor Day. So I'll drink to that, and we'll see you then. This meeting's adjourned.